this seems to be the new trend, something that's happening across the region, is people being moved from prison into labor situations.
New reports of Uyghurs being forced into Chinese labor camps. It's Monday, December 17th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, new strategies emerged to counter China in Africa. The complicated Huawei case. Fewer sharks in Australian waters. Taxi driver pinups for your wall. A winning solar home. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Some of the hundreds of thousands of Muslim Uyghurs who are being rounded up by Chinese authorities and put into massive re-education camps in western China are being moved into forced labor. The New York Times Sunday reported that thousands have been shown on Chinese television as what the report said were models of repentance, earning good pay and political salvation as factory workers. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke on Skype about this with Darren Byler, a lecturer at the University of Washington in Seattle. His focus is on the plight of China's Uyghur population. He toured the area of western China in April.
What's happening is something quite new, really just since September or October of this year, 2018, we've begun to see Uyghurs that have been detained in re-education camps, internment camps, seeing them moved from the confinement space, from the prison space, into working spaces. Oftentimes really located very close to the camp, so often inside the same compound. And this seems to be the new trend, something that's happening across the province, across the region, is people being moved from prison into labor situations.
The Chinese are saying that they are educating the people to become more valuable Chinese citizens living inside the borders of China by, number one, giving them language, because many do not speak Chinese, and the second, to give them valuable tools. How do you counter that?
That is their approach, is to train people to speak Chinese. In the camp system, Uyghurs are not permitted to use their own language. Instead, they have to only speak in Chinese, and being in order to graduate from the camp system and work and move into the factory space, you need to pass Chinese language exams. So that's the reports we've heard. You also need to pass ideology tests, your political acumen, you proving that you're loyal to the state and that you are repentant for your past, you know, religious behavior, your past belief in Islam, all of those sorts of things.
You apparently spoke to some people who had intimate knowledge of what is happening now as far as the forced labor is concerned. Can you relate that to us?
Yeah, I won't speak in very specific terms because I need to protect the identities of my Uyghur contacts. But what one person told me is that his brother was scheduled to graduate from the camp because he had passed all of these tests of language and ideology. But as he was being released, they then gave him a 3-year sentence of labor in a clothing factory. And he's now working as a seamstress, running a sewing machine in this factory. They also told him that if he works hard, works well, that it's possible he could be released after 1 year and then be placed under house arrest. And continue his work in a garment factory. So this suggests to me a few things. One of the things it suggests is that the people that are being sent from the camps into these other spaces are people that are in the most lenient level of the camp, because there's around 4 levels from what we've heard in the camps, people that are under, you know, stringent guard to the most lenient level. And I think the people that are released, sent to work in factories, are people that are in that most lenient category, people that are seen as pliable and having a potential future as productive workers.
So that could be the very reason the Chinese are doing this. The Chinese are saying that there are some terrorism involved here, or terrorists living among the population. Do they have any validity in what they're claiming?
There has been violent incidents in the past that the Chinese state has characterized as terrorist. Some of them do sort of meet international standards of terrorist activities, but only, out of the many that they label that in those ways, only, a handful. So in general, it's not that. Most people that have, harbored unauthorized religious views are not interested in any sort of political Islam or violent resistance. Instead, they're just interested in understanding what it means to be Muslim and practicing their faith. So the government's reaction to this is quite an overreach in many ways.
Many people say that forced labor brings to mind North Korea and people ending up being killed trying to escape. Is there anything that severe happening in China?
Well, I think they are being held under armed guard in these factory spaces, so it's not possible to leave them. The factories are still part of the prison system. So it is possible. We don't know what conditions people are being held in, how well they're being fed, if they're being compensated in any way. My sense, though, is that moving from the camp system, from the prison space into the factory space is seen as a benefit, is seen as a by the Uyghurs themselves as something that now they're actually able to do something rather than simply sit in prison. And they're also given more visits with family. And also them talking about there being like a 3-year program in place, that implies something of an end date, that there's eventually Uyghurs will maybe move out of the forced labor system into something else. But of course, they're always going to be watched. I don't think this camp system is going away anytime soon.
Darren told us that China has gone from denying the existence of the camps to its stance that the camps are bringing about positive results. That change, he says, might be due to increased Western media coverage. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. North Korea marks 7th anniversary of Kim Jong-il death. Is Trump on path to strategic patience on North Korea? Executives arrest, security worries, stymie Huawei's reach. U.S. and Canada promise fair process for Chinese tech executive. Afghanistan, China, and Pakistan ink deal to enhance counter-terror cooperation. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The Trump administration has unveiled a new strategy for Africa that's focused on countering Chinese and Russian influence on the resource-rich continent. And the administration is demanding more accountability for American aid. VOA's Patsy Whitaker-Swara has more from the White House.
Chinese President Xi Jinping has long been courting African leaders at events like September's China-Africa Forum. Chinese-funded infrastructure projects are popping up all over Africa. At the conservative-leaning think tank, the Heritage Foundation, the administration launched a new strategy on Africa.
Well, Kim, thanks very much.
Officials say it's designed to counter China's growing power, as well as Russia's attempts to increase its influence in the resource-rich continent.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Bolton said the goal of the strategy is to advance trade and commercial ties, counter the threat of terrorism, and ensure accountability for American aid.
We had the speech. We'll take a look at the speech and look at the detail of the speech, and we'll give a comment later on that. But we are happy to understand that finally, American has a strategy that is purposeful towards Africa.
The new Africa strategy is in line with the Trump administration's foreign policy that portrays China as a strategic competitor. Some analysts see the us-versus-them approach as counterproductive, including Mike Fuchs from the left-leaning Center for American Progress.
Which we should be creating partnerships with countries in Africa based on our interests and how we can work together to pursue shared interests. This is not, again, a battleground between the United States and China, but framing it that way is going to, I think, leave a bad taste in the mouth probably of a lot of the leaders and the people, frankly, in Africa.
Bolton also warned the U.S. will reevaluate its support for U.N. peacekeeping missions.
We will seek to streamline, reconfigure, or terminate missions that are unable to meet their own mandate or facilitate lasting peace. Our objective is to resolve conflicts, not freeze them in perpetuity.
The U.S. will also review aid to countries whose governance it finds unaccountable. Bolton singled out South Sudan, signaling that all aid may soon end for the war-torn country. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Happening now, a New Hampshire husband and wife used a messaging system popular in China to entice women to come to the United States on a tourist visa and serve in the sex industry in northern New England, according to court documents. Prosecutors say the pair orchestrated an elaborate scheme involving at least 27 women. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're starting out a brand new week. We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. China has rallied the power of its one-party state behind tech giant Huawei to boost public support for the company's chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou. But the case is getting increasingly complex, with the arrest of two Canadian citizens in apparent retaliation as Meng awaits possible extradition to the United States from Canada. VOA's Bill Ide files from Beijing.
Before Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou was released on bail earlier this week, China moved quickly, arresting a Canadian businessman and a former diplomat. Beijing says the cases are not connected, but has made it clear from the start that if Meng is not released immediately, there will be consequences. An online video commentary from the editor-in-chief of the party-backed nationalistic tabloid, The Global Times, and its headline was blunter.
China will definitely take retaliatory measures against Canada. I believe Canada expects as much along with international public.
Not all agree with Hu's interpretation of public opinion and the Huawei case, or the arrests of the two Canadian citizens in China. In a Skype interview, human rights lawyer Dr. Teng Biao told VOA's Mandarin service that the vague charges of violating national security that both men face can easily be used for political manipulation.
Based on previous cases, many people's normal activities, such as rights activism, have also been charged as subversion of state power or inciting subversion of state power.
The businessman, Michael Spavor, has deep contacts with North Korea and previously helped former NBA star Dennis Rodman on trips to the reclusive country to meet leader Kim Jong-un. Michael Korvig currently works for the Hong Kong-based International Crisis Group. He took a leave of absence from the Canadian Foreign Affairs Department in 2016. As for Meng, U.S. authorities allege she misled banks about Huawei's control of a company operating in Iran. Those actions put the banks at risk of violating U.S. sanctions. Canada says it is handling her case in accordance with the law, but has also urged Washington not to politicize the process. Earlier this week, President Donald Trump told Reuters in an interview that he could intervene in the case if it would help secure a trade deal with Beijing. On the streets in Beijing, some we spoke with expressed support for Meng and concern that the case is more about limiting the tech giant's competitive ability.
U.S. law has always encouraged competition because it's only through competition that societies and technology advance.
The U.S. has shown growing fears about the rise and development of China.
However, when asked whether they agreed with calls from state media and companies in China to boycott products such as Apple in response, those we spoke with said That is more a matter of personal choice. Bill Eyde, VOA News, Beijing.
Coming up, fewer sharks may be good for swimmers, but not for the sharks. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
News from VOA Asia. China, Pakistan, and Afghanistan have signed a trilateral understanding to enhance counterterrorism security, cooperation, and collectively reiterated their call for the Taliban insurgency to join Afghan peace talks. The foreign ministers of the three countries met in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Meet with us at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, shark numbers along the Queensland coast have declined by more than 90% for some species in the past 5 decades. That's according to new research that calls for better protection for threatened species in Australian waters. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia has 170 types of sharks out of approximately 440 species globally. Great white and grey nurse sharks already are listed as threatened in Australian waters. Researchers from the University of Queensland and Griffith University have analysed data from shark control programs to gauge changes in populations over the past 5 decades. Nets and baited hooks have been used in Queensland to reduce the risk of attacks on swimmers and surfers. The research teams looked at the number of white, tiger, hammerhead and whaler sharks caught between the early 1960s to 2016. What they found was a shock, according to George Roth from the University of Queensland, who was one of the authors of the study.
The results are quite striking. So what we found over the last 50 years is a dramatic decline in the numbers of apex sharks on the Queensland coastline. So the number of large sharks on our beaches have declined by between 74 and 92%. At the same time, the size of the sharks are also getting smaller. So there are fewer and smaller sharks on Queensland beaches than there were 50 years ago. This includes the globally endangered hammerhead sharks that have declined by up to 92%. And importantly, white sharks that are listed as vulnerable in Australia have shown no sign of recovery, despite protections that have been put in place over 2 decades ago to stop fishing.
Researchers are blaming overfishing for a sharp fall in hammerhead and great white shark populations. They say that the apparent collapse of certain shark species would indicate that the overall health of the oceans is also in decline. They say there should be greater protection for some of nature's greatest scavengers and predators. Scientists insist that factors such as climate change, which is affecting shark numbers, couldn't explain the scale of the decline. In January 2014, the Western Australian government responded to a series of attacks with a controversial catch-and-kill policy. Almost 70 sharks were caught and shot before the strategy was abandoned after a recommendation by environmental officials. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia. North Koreans have marked the anniversary of the death of leader Kim Jong-il 7 years ago with visits to statues and vows of loyalty to his son Kim Jong-un. A steady flow of North Koreans offered flowers and paid respects to the late leader in central Pyongyang, the location of huge bronze statues. Cute stories and unique features are found daily on VOA Asia Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, with the New Year just weeks away, New York taxi drivers have prepared their own unique gift to the city. It's a 2019 calendar featuring themselves. Statistics say around 90% of yellow cab drivers are immigrants, and the calendar, which is a comedic take on the traditional pinup, draws attention to this fact while being light and entertaining. Ina Vishneva reports from New York City in the story narrated by Anna Rice.
Cab driver Greg Witkin knows practically every street in New York City, but you might not think he knows much about modeling. Enter in this unique taxi driver calendar where Witkin posed to be featured for the month of October. The idea to create a calendar for cabbies, now in its sixth year, belongs to Shannon and Philip Kirkman. Shannon takes the pictures, Philip deals with finances and scheduling.
These men and women are heroes of our city. They help us get around this city 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
There are more than 13,000 yellow taxis in the New York City, driven by 50,000 people from all over the world. 90% of them are immigrants, according to city statistics. And this year, the Kirkmans thought it would be a neat idea for each of the drivers featured in the 2019 calendar to represent a different ethnic group.
Several different countries in Africa, all over Europe. We've had Russian driver, South Asian. We've had South American drivers. So lots of different diversity in the calendar. And that's a good representation of New York City.
It goes from mild to wild. Mike knows how to throw a lasso. Nazmil offers coffee to all seriously caffeine-deprived passengers. Alam picks just the right music for the ride, and Alex can handle any situation on the road, even if it involves a giant snake. Shannon and Philip say they thought through every little detail.
We explore a couple different avenues. First is our different things that individuals do with their cars, whether it's, you know, wiping a windshield or changing a tire or even, you know, getting locked out of the cab.
Shannon and Philip wanted to show that taxi drivers in Manhattan are more than just cabbies. Greg, for example, is currently working on creating a website dedicated to the city.
A lot of people who ride with me only see the back of my head. Sometimes we don't even talk. And on the website, I can write a lot about New York. I can write about myself and other taxi drivers.
A portion of each calendar sale benefits University Settlement, an organization that helps immigrants and their families. Vanina Vishnyova in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
It's official. A team of faculty and students from Virginia Tech University have built what is being billed as the world's best solar home. The decision was made in Dubai when officials announced the winner of the Solar Decathlon Middle East competition. VOA's Kevin Enix shed some more light.
If you want to see the home of the future, look no further. This modular-designed home was 10 years in the making, but assembled in less than a week.
We set it up in 2 days. We had it assembled. All the other teams, it took them the full 2 weeks of construction. Ours was set up in 2 days, generating power on the third day by the sun.
The quick assembly time is just one thing that makes this home special. All of it comes in modules that are literally popped together on site into a fully functioning plug-and-play house.
Our typical cartridge is 3 foot wide and about 12 feet long and no higher than 10 feet tall. That cartridge contains the structure of the house. It's got the structural walls, load-bearing walls. It's got the insulation in it. But it's got all of the plumbing and all of the electrical systems pre-installed.
It seems incredibly high-tech, but one of the team members says it's a natural progression for our homes to start being as smart as all of our other stuff.
I think we already have our phones, our cars, all of these pieces of technology that are accessories, if you will, that we bring with us that have become the expectation that they are smart, that they are aiding us in the way that we're living our lives, and yet we go home and we kind of shut all that away.
But this isn't just an ivory tower science experiment. The team members say they will be building their first functional move-in ready home this spring, and that all they are doing is introducing the world to the next generation of home building.
We envision that one day in the very near future, you're going to be able to go on to Amazon. You're going to be able to pick out the features, the appliances, the finishes that you want in your kitchen and your bathroom and your bedroom, and you're going to place those in your shopping cart.
The team says they are in talks with a number of home building companies and hope to begin scaling up their new modular home kits in the near future. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. You'll also find us, of course, on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. VOA Asia Facebook, a great way to get in touch with us if you'd like to send us a message. You can also send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. And, of course, you can hear us on the radio. Great radio stations across Asia. like DZUP 1602 AM Radio at the University of the Philippines Diliman in Quezon City. Thanks for tuning in. Our thanks as well go to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Aiden Utku, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Have a nice day.